Welcome to Cloud Foundry Weekly, your source for all things Cloud Foundry. On today's episode, Nikki will deep dive with Tim Leong, Chris Samp, and Mark Fiennes about what it's like to live a day in the life of the VMware Tanzu Solution Architect. Please enjoy the show.
Happy Thursday, everybody, and welcome to Season 1, Episode 9 of Cloud Foundry Weekly. As you can tell, I am by myself. Oops, sorry about that. Looks like we had a little technical glitch there, but welcome to this episode. As you can see, I am by myself today, still working remotely, but Nick is off today taking care of some personal business. But we do have a great episode for you today. We're going to have three guys that, you know, I get the honor to work with every day. We're going to be talking about what it's like in the day in the life of the Cloud Foundry, or as a solutions architect dealing with Cloud Foundry and Tanzu Application Service. One thing I do want to mention, I just want to remind everybody, we've got Cloud Foundry Day coming up on May 15th. We're going to be out there. Cloud Foundry is going to be, or Cloud Foundry Weekly is going to be doing a live episode from Cloud Foundry Day. It's going to be ending the show for us, and we're going to have a panel with some customers. We'll talk about that a little bit in the show. We've got Tim Leong, who's going to be coming on, who knows some of the customers that are going to be on the panel with us. We've got Chris Samp, and we got Mark Fiennes. So we're going to start bringing these guys in, letting you introduce. The first one that we're going to bring in is Chris Samp. So Chris Samp is, he started out in the Silicon Valley in the dot-com era. He comes in with expertise in Java, AWS, Bash Scripts, Python, and he was a VP of engineering background at some of the startups that he worked on. He brings a wealth of experience to this role. And he joined Pivotal, engaging with major companies, major, you know, automotive companies for quite a while. He deals with a lot of big accounts, and he's really working on helping kind of evolving the tech terrain with a focus on Cloud Foundry. So we're going to go ahead and bring Chris in. How you doing, Chris?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, man. So you saw my introduction there. What else can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, I think it's material that I come really from a long development background, like fighting it out with Java and in my IDE and getting code to work. And sometimes, you know, early you kind of have to go into the infrastructure layers and things like that. But that had never been my intent. I kind of am happy to end up here because I always found that you could just redo your, you know, you could restart your code, run through your breakpoints, have everything be as it was and repeat the experiment. But when you got into the infrastructure layer, that was harder and harder to do. And all of this immutable stuff, it both helps with that, and it brings on other problems too with data and stuff. So I think that's my background and lens into this stack.
Perfect. Well, we'll be getting into more of that here later. Let's go ahead, and we're going to be the second person that we're going to bring in is going to be Mark Fiennes. Now, Mark is special to me, so you know, we'll go ahead and bring him on. But, you know, Mark comes in with 25 years of experience. He's done everything from middleware, corporate middleware, to web services, to various platforms. You know, he's been a part of Pivotal since, I think, 2013. And the interesting story here is that Mark was my SA when I was a customer. And we spent many a nights, long nights together working on Cloud Foundry. And you know, to be honest, we still work together, but I miss some of those nights, Mark. I mean, we come up with some pretty cool stuff when I was a customer.
Great times. Absolutely. And yeah, you know, from my perspective, like you said, I had a middleware background forever. And I saw what a platform as a service like Cloud Foundry could do. I went, that's your holy grail. That's your North Star for what middleware is trying to be when it grows up. And, you know, and you couple that with, like you say, the personal side of this, right? We get to work with some great customers and they can come and join us.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, Deshaun put up there, you know, Jedi and Padawan. You're not far off. I mean, I do credit Mark with help bringing me into this industry, getting me, you know, really interested in Cloud Foundry and kind of found a second home. And he had a lot to do with me, you know, moving over to the VMware Pivotal side. So you're not far off, Deshaun.
The force is
strong. All right. Do what?
The force is strong.
The force is strong. And the last guy we're going to bring in is going to be Tim Leong. So Tim is a 10-year Cloud Foundry veteran. He managed the platforms for some major corporations, which we're going to talk about here in a little bit because he's going to kind of got to tie into what we're doing at the Cloud Foundry Day. So two of the people on the panel are going to be his ex-customers. He lives in Philly with his wife and three kids, and apparently you live near a mall where George Washington used to hang out. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So anybody who knows about the Philly area knows what mall I'm talking about. It's King of Prussia Mall. I live not too far from that. And oddly enough, it's near Valley Forge, where George Washington hung out for a winter. So it's you get a bit of the old and the new from where I am. Kind of like this call, a little bit of the old and the new, right? So it's great to be here. Like you said, I 10 years experience with Cloud Foundry. I come from the opposite spectrum of Chris and Finzi here. I started off as a Linux administrator, so working with infrastructure, building servers, racking servers, wiring servers in the data center, building automation around that, taking it up through infrastructure as a service, and then being put onto this amazing platform that has basically defined my career for the last decade. So happy to be here, happy to continue to be using it, and happy to be here talking with you guys. So thank you.
Well, it's interesting, Tim, you bring up being a Linux engineer. I've told the story before, but I'm gonna tell it again, right? I started off, I was a Windows fanboy for like 20 plus years. All I worked in was Microsoft. When I came over and started working on Cloud Foundry, first thing that they did was, you know, I got a Mac computer, and then, hey, here's this platform that runs off of Linux. What the hell am I supposed to do with this, man? It confused me. It took me probably 3 or 4 months to really get in the groove. And now I cannot get onto a Windows computer without it just absolutely just irritating the crap out of me, right? So I am jealous that you got started as a Linux engineer. If I had my life to do over again, I probably would have started that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't my fault. Somebody picked it for me. As it goes, you know, they said, you're going to work on Unix. And I was like, okay. So yeah, that's how I kind of got started and never looked back.
Well, and yeah, it seems like you're a popular guy. We got Wayne and Surat both yelling out your name saying, hey, Tim. Yeah. So you got some fans out there today.
Yep. Good to see you. Good to see you guys virtually on the chat room there.
Cool. Well, we're going to start off. First question, like we always do, Chris, we're going to start with you. First question we ask everybody, talk to us about your first CF push experience. What was it like?
My first CF push was pretty far as I was about to interview with Pivotal. I figured I better figure this thing out and give it a try. the whole thing made a lot of natural sense to me. I was kind of, it was fun to see it in motion. You know, my story there was I was kind of unhappily orchestrating AWS stuff with Bash and Python, trying to fan out a bunch of servers and collect data and looking at alternatives. And I got a call from the Pivotal recruiter because I was in near the Detroit area. There's some customers there. And he said, hey, there's this Cloud Foundry thing. I'm like, is that like Kubernetes? And there's a pause. He's like, let's talk. I think you might know what I'm talking about. So I figured I might as well at least try it. I got really lucky, I think, because it just matched with so many of my instincts about how things ought to be done to do good quality development work. It was not that hard to just say, okay, we've only done it once. Let's interview about it.
Cool. Well, we'll put a pin in the AWS stuff because we'll probably bring that up in a little bit. But Mark Finzi, what about you, man? What was your first CF push experience? 2013. We're going to be taking back in the day with yours. So
next in the memory here. So I was working at a startup, and I was introduced to this group of guys that were spinning out of VMware on this Pivotal One initiative, and they were having entirely too much fun. They just were. And I'll never forget, you know, I think it was probably product manager number one here, but one of the guys does this push command. And I went, wait, hang on a second here. And I'm thinking in my head how much, you know, with middleware, you might be able to help with a networking code and web services show some standard interop, but I wasn't getting down into the weeds of how you're going to get your assets deployed all the time because I was expecting a place to land the code. Now, I really had a this changes everything feeling. And then the irony of ironies, and I would say that if you peel the onion on Cloud Foundry, CF push is the most famous API command, but it isn't even the most powerful one. Like, we all know what it means to have a space. And we all know what our marketplace can do for you. And so, you know, you got there, and I think it was one of those unique products where that CF push experience would like wow you, but the more you peel the onion, the more goodness was hiding behind it. What else was there all the way down to Bosch?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was a simple hello world, I think, but it was enough. It got me really excited really early on.
Yeah, and it's, you know, CF push. And the reason we ask that question, that's the tip of the iceberg, right? That's that's taking the code and putting it out there. But man, there's so much stuff behind, you know, below the surface that that Cloud Foundry and TAS do for you that people don't even think about. You know, the talk about abstraction, right? How we abstract out the infrastructure and make it to where the devs really don't care. And they don't need to know any of that stuff. It takes a lot of pressure off the devs. It makes for a really good experience.
Yeah, I'll just wrap that with, I remember talking to an executive the following year, and he goes, here's the 60 steps we have to get something running in production. Which one do you automate? And I said, well, with all due respect, it's not the right question. I'm not automating 60 steps. There just aren't 60 steps.
Right.
You know? And it was funny because you're getting into abstractions versus automation, but you could show CF push to anybody at any level in an organization, and they may not be used to looking at technology, and you say, just watch your stopwatch. This will be running in 2 minutes. And you didn't have to call 9 people. Right? Yeah. It's just, there's something unique in history about that.
I think the speed is nice. It's the repeatability that I think really drew me in. I, you know, having fought with Java stacks and like deploying to server long-lived servers, and there's dependencies that change. It was you know, very frustrating. I'm sure this group knows that. I remember having arguments with my system administrators, my VMware administrators in, I don't know, 2010 plus or minus, about, look, just give me some call that I can get a fresh VM every time. And maybe I'll call it 10 times a day. Every time it's going to be exactly known. I'm going to apply some exact stuff to it. And then we're going to get rid of all of these variables. And they just looked at me like, you want me to do what? How many VMs do you need? 10 VMs a day? That's going to add up. I'm like, no, I just need them for a minute. That's kind of where we kind of ended up.
Yeah. Yep. And I would say not only the repeatability, but the consistency.
Yeah.
Right. When we're talking about polyglot, the fact that, you know, your Java code, CF push works the same with Java as it does Go, as it does with Python, so on and so forth. You know, that experience and, you know, not having to have different methods of trying to get your code out there. Again, that's one of the benefits. And Tim, we're not going to leave you out. One thing I want to say about Tim. So Tim is the co-lead with me on the TAS TSL. TSL stands for Tanzu Service Leads. So we're the group that helps others, solution architects and account executives, learn about the product, get answers from products. So he is a co-lead on that. So the two of us together, he is my other partner in crime along with Nick Kuhn. What about your first CF push, Tim?
Yeah. I mean, my first CF push was kind of like, you know, waiting for a roller coaster, right? So my manager at the time told me, we're doing this thing with Pivotal to look at this thing called Cloud Foundry, because we had to build this platform. We were looking at platforms that we could build to help our developers. And I was like, all right. So we took a, you know, there was a session going on in Denver. We got on a plane, got into the hotel. The next day we started the class, did a CF push, and in 5 minutes it was done. I was like, it's like waiting for a roller coaster for an hour, and then the ride was done in 5 minutes. I was like, that was it. So, you know, for me, that was amazing. But being as the platform engineer coming from the infrastructure side, it was my job to actually, after that CF push was done, to actually make it live and make it work, right? Mm-hmm. So my amazement actually was more in the installing and building and managing the platform after the fact. Mm-hmm. So where I was amazed was on the Bosch side and being able to stand up the platform in a day, which was unreal. After me and another architect that I was working with at the time, we were screwing around with OpenShift for the last two months. I don't know if you guys remember what OpenShift used to look like back in those days with gears and all sorts of other nonsense that we were struggling with. And then we come to this platform and we were able to stand it up in a day, and mean time to value was hours, which just blew me away. Because we also had to build an infrastructure as a service platform customized. And that took us months. So, I mean, it was a total mind shift for me. So, definitely knew that, something special was about to happen, and it did.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I think, you know, Tim, you kind of hit on a point, which I think we're probably going to spend a lot of time on today is, you know, generally during these shows, we talk about what it's like from the developer experience. We talk about how this means to developers, but one of the things that I think we kind of lean off is what is actually the benefit to the business? What's the benefit to the guys that are managing the platform? You know, you look at platforms, you know, and you look at Kubernetes, you look at, like Chris was talking about, native, you know, hyperscalers and public cloud. You have these huge teams that have to manage this infrastructure and these platforms for these teams. Whereas when we talk about, you know, Cloud Foundry, we're getting, you know, 500 to 1, 600 to 1, all the way up to 1200 to 1 developer to PE ratios. So I think we're going to dig into that a little bit more as well. You know, what does this mean from a platform perspective and the guys that are running it? How does that translate into business? So maybe this episode won't be so much about developers. Sorry, developers. You get a lot of the limelight, but I think we're going to talk about the unsung heroes and the guys that keep the platforms up on this. Any thoughts before we go on?
I'll kick off. Like, I always would say that when we were bringing into a new organization, to a new customer, or potential customer, you kind of had five battles to win. Mm-hmm. Your developers, you needed to go in there first. And obviously, you could make them happy quickly. And then we'd say, you know, if you think it's good for you, the operators are going to be blown away because it's like 10 times more efficient on the operational side.
Yeah.
You'd have to go to your app or line of business owner and show what it means when you have all your developers happy and doing just test cases and business logic and not waiting. And then you'd go down to the, you'd obviously show the operator the magic that is Bosch, which is a whole other superpower. And then you'd have your security officer. That was always the fun around the Ferris wheel of security controls we have. We show, no, it's different, but it's better. And lastly, your exec needed to give you a like air cover. You know, this was a different thing. And I think an awful lot of this was about education.
Agreed. The security guys, we always called them the traffic cops, right? Nobody could put a stop to anything as fast as security.
Yeah.
So when we lead off into this, right? So, you know, I want to ask you each, and we'll kind of go around the board, what got you into solutions architecture? What got you into kind of the technical sales role? You know, I'll start and say when I was a customer, I was blown away by Cloud Foundry. It was one of those things. It was one of the most exciting products I ever worked on. I saw the benefit from it. And that's the reason I wanted to get into the role that I'm in now, is I wanted to help other customers do the same thing that I was able to do, you know, at my previous job. You know, Tim, we'll start with you. What got you into solutions architect? What made you want to be a solutions architect, and kind of how do you feel about it today?
Well, I just feel like I was kind of doing this job the last 10 years, right? So nobody knows what Cloud Foundry is unless you're part of this crew, right? So unless you're a platform engineer, you need to sell it, right? You need to be able to convince others that this is so great. And this is what you have to do even internally. So, you know, one of the funny things is when we started this off, nobody knew what this was. So I had to create posters that I would post around the office. And what did it say? The poster just said, Cloud Foundry is just too hard. And then the quote was by no one.
Right.
So we put those all around, sort of trying to gain interest. And some of the people, you know, maybe the folks on the call remember those posters. I hear they're still up 10 years later. Nobody took them down, but... So like I've always been kind of doing this job, and I think a lot of, you know, platform engineers need to sort of promote. And then coming into solutions architecture, it's sort of the same job, just trying to help people understand technology, help people, you know, solve problems with technology, find the right path forward. Coming here, just getting more access to lots of different workloads, lots of different use cases and customers is just always interesting. So that's what drove me.
Yeah, and Tim is one of the most creative guys I've seen when it comes to promoting TAS. So he showed me this demo of where he's taken parts of Cloud Foundry and he's putting them into like Pokemon cards so that you could start trading, right? And like Bosch is like the super Pokemon that's up there. But he's starting to make these, and I thought, man, that is I would never think about that. That's a hell of a creative idea to get out there. Have you got to show any of those to customers yet, or are you still working
on it? I just kind of sent them out, see what people think. But yeah, the Cloud Foundry Pokemon was powerful.
Like, yeah,
FCF push attack was like 500 hit points.
So I think you should get us a couple of those. I think we need to take them to Cloud Foundry Day. We need to throw them out there and see who likes them, and see if we can't get people, you know, kind of trading Cloud Foundry Pokemon cards. Collect them all.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got it. Once you get a full set, you got to build the whole thing, right? Chris, how about you? Why did you want to get into being an SA?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, to Tim's comment that, you know, I've kind of always been doing the job. I've never quite wanted to be in one particular box, and it's an interesting way to be in a couple at the same time. You know, even so, I was a computer nerd in high school. I tested out of computer science, and then I went and studied electrical engineering and technical writing. Then I got a job with a consulting company doing documentation that led into, I think it was actually sales engineering. I'd go out with the sales guy and I'd talk about technology, and usually in rooms that people were not technical, so I seemed technical. But I was always afraid I would run into an actual technical person, which couldn't be me. So I'm like, well, I got to go get a development job. And so I got a product engineering job, and I did that for, I don't know, like 20 years. But even looking at it, you know, I did things like try to do product management and internally change from a kind of fractional product, fractional bunch of projects to a single product that we could deploy in different circumstances. I went to business school. I got into infra when the devs couldn't help. And then I helped the infra guys understand what devs were trying to do. And then really, I got a call at the right time to, hey, you want to come work with work for Pivotal and work with this local automotive manufacturer. And I couldn't really fathom what the job quite meant then. Like, I'm like, well, am I going to get a desk there? Am I going to be like on call? I guess I was maybe thinking of what we'd call a technical account manager or a resident who kind of stays there all the time.
Right.
Then kind of realized more of the selling side of it. But still, you know, I've been doing this now for about 5 years. I've gotten, I think, pretty used to the dimensions of it, but still really come at it from a technology first. Like, let's find the engineers, let's talk about them, or even to non-technical people. Hey, just wait until your engineers come and, you know, I get to talk to them. And fortunately, with a product like Cloud Foundry and the things around it, I never have to like bluff or like say things that aren't true. I can always come out, make these bold statements and say, and then let's walk through it. Don't believe me. I'll show you. Oh, you have a criticism? Great. Let's hear it. Let's explore it. Let's find out where that goes. So it's really been a good spot, I think, to learn the trade.
Yeah. Chris, I think in my opinion, you're like the definitive solutions architect that I've worked with here.
I agree.
I definitely respect the amount of wide breadth of knowledge that you have across a number of different topics. So
I never thought that was going to be useful, you know, because it's like, I don't know half this stuff until I walked in to my customer early on and they said, hey, none of this stuff is working. We're trying to launch this and it keeps crashing and we load on some traffic and it flops. I'm like, well, I don't know that much about this plan. I mean, what am I going to do? Am I going to debug something? Are there logs I got to look at? And I'm like, you know, I'm going to look at their load test results and see how that went and go from there. And so I'm like, okay, guys, can you show me your load test results? And they all just looked at me like, what load test? What do you mean? I'm like, well, you know, when you run it and then it crashes and you find out why and you fix it. Oh no, we don't do that. We just have these scheduled tests. And I'm like, you do what? and then they're like, okay, tell us what to do. And for the next 2 weeks, I just did what I thought was relatively straightforward software engineering. Let's get it to work. Stuff, and they're like, oh, you must really know what you're talking about here. So
well, that's what gets at the core of what you do is you ask questions. Like asking questions is so important. It's a skill that I'm still learning, but like, you know, when you come across these things, you're like, oh, how are you load testing it? And that just opens up a wide thing. So like getting back to the theme there, Nikki, about day in the life is learning the right questions to ask, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Agreed. So, and Mark, we're going to lead you in with the comment we just had up from Wayne, which I thought was awesome, right? Bosch is ops over oops. I couldn't agree with that more. I'm going to steal that, Wayne. We're going to use that. But what brought you into solutions architecture?
Yeah. I'm going to just, before I say the answer to that, I'm going to call that another Wayne quote. I don't always test, but when I do, it's in production. Love it.
Yep.
And that reminds me of one, I think it was Waters or one of the guys, you know, great job manually patching those operating systems, said no CIO ever.
Right.
And you can take that at any level. That's like the Russian doll pitch, because it can be about the Bosch layer or about the AIs, the containerized apps inside. For me, pre-sales was something I'll never forget. A colleague, a friend of mine, after college, said he's going to be a sales engineer. What's that? And I had no idea what it was. And he said, well, you know, you're going to be with Intel with a salesperson. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'd like that. And that's very early in my career. And then I found out, wait a minute, you can be the technologist. You can get this massive exposure because you're going to see other customers' problems, prospect problems all the time. And you get to be a bit more extrovert. You get to blend being able to whiteboard with customers, learn about their environments, learn about their problems you're having, and then try and solve problems for them. And that part, where you're able to kind of innovate and solve problems for people, I got a great kick out of that. Whether it be, you know, some cool new technical way to do something, or it be sometimes more in the personal side, that there can be not just a technical solution, but then some way to chart getting that, you know, available to them. Yeah. So I have in some way, shape, or form always been in this kind of a role. And, you know, I always remember one time I went off into the paid for consulting, and I'll never forget it. I always remember thinking, wow, someone turned off the radio, because we work on a lot of different things.
Yep.
In a solution architecture role, you know, bill on the one project for a year type thing. So yeah, it's been a good fit for me, I think.
Well, yeah. And you know, that's interesting, because it seems like everybody has the word engineer or architect after their title anymore. And you know, that's one of the things I want to talk about when we talk about solutions architecture. It really is architecture, right? You're not only putting together a plan for the customer, and I want each one of you to kind of talk about this. You're not only putting together technically what the customer needs, but you're putting it together in a way that makes financial and fiduciary sense to them. You're putting it together in a way that they can actually adopt, and you're building adoption plans. So when we talk solutions architecture with customers, we're architecting how they're going to not only start this system from a technical, but how they're going to maintain it from, you know, day two all the way through, you know, how is this going to pay for itself? I mean, Mark, we've helped customers develop, you helped me develop, you know, chargeback plans that made the platform self-funding, right? So that, you know, you got this big up investment, you don't want to become a cost sinkhole. So you help architect the play that you're going to go around to help the customer come self-funding, keep that platform up and grow. Let's kind of talk about, you know, either examples or things that you've done, what architecture means in a sales role for the customer. Let's start with you, Chris.
Yeah, I'm going to defer some of what I think Feinzie and Tim might say around chargeback and repeatability, things like that, because sometimes I find that even once you have all of those stuff, it's can still be a challenge to work with the right people, because of some of these bigger organizations are quite siloed, like incredibly so, particularly where the developers are over there and the ops people are over here, and the ops people, sure, they're working and they can see some value about the leverage, but they don't really benefit from the platform in the same way as the developers do. They don't even know the developers. Maybe they've never even been developers, so they don't know what it's like. And if there's 5,000 developers over there, 4,500 of them are, hey, it's 5 o'clock, I'm going to go see my kid's soccer game. And, you know, they use CF Push all day. And so they can go, they don't complain, they don't say anything. And there's not the feedback loop isn't complete. They're just taking their what is a good tool and using it. And the ops people just see, we're just kind of keeping this going. Nobody talks to us very much about how good it is. And shouldn't we be working harder? Shouldn't we be building something more complicated? You know, we just do applied changes and then, you know, talk to each other for a minute. And it can seem almost like not, you know, tough enough, right? Mm-hmm. And you almost don't believe some of these things that you hear, and you're like, well, why don't we go run on some hyperscaler? Oh, let's adopt Kubernetes. There's some good trade shows about that I can go to and have papers. And just the way these alignments, these incentives don't always line up. So I think in terms of plans for the customer, just trying to create those loops is really what I've often tried to do.
And I don't think you meant it, but you just showed a good example of how architects, you know, one of the things that we sometimes have to do is we have to change a company's mentality about how they look at a product. You brought up two things there. well, this just doesn't seem hard enough. Okay, you know, people have a mentality. If it's not difficult, if I'm not spending a lot of hours on it, then I'm not really working. Well, that's not true. We've got to change that mentality. The other thing that you talked about was that inner and outer loop that we often talk about with developers, and getting that mindset of DevOps and SecDevOps, where everybody's working together, they're not working in silos, and how that can, you know, bring about a better product for the customer. So, you know, I don't know whether you meant to or not, Chris, but you just highlighted in my mind perfectly what a solution architect does, right? Change hearts and minds, and we try to build something better for the customer, make them more efficient.
I'll choose box number one. I meant to do that.
Right on. Yep. Hey, if it works, it works, right? Tim, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's been kind of a shift for me, because like Finzi said, like when you get hired, it's sales engineer and you're like, sales, right? So you don't want to be kind of in that kind of role of, you know, selling products, but you're not really. It's finding problems and finding solutions and becoming that sort of that technical advisor, that trusted advisor. And I was told that when I interviewed, and that's what really drove me to this, is the trusted advisor. Yes. Getting in there, giving your opinion, making sure that it is sound, and that the solution fits the need. And even if it's not what you're selling, that's okay. You know, if they have a need that you're not able to satisfy, it's okay. And just having that empathy and being able to have these kinds of conversations where they can honestly trust what you're saying. I think that's what it means, is building that trust and working together to come up with solutions.
Yep. Got another quote from Wayne. Wayne, I love the fact that you're being so active today, man. This is awesome. But SA means savior, technically speaking. And I think you're right. You know, when it comes into, you know, that trusted advisor role, I was very scared about being a quote unquote sales guy. When you think about sales, people look at, you know, used car dealers, right? They're slimy. They're just trying to do anything out the board. But as SAs, that's not what we do. We really are. We're trying to find the best solution for a customer, help make sure they've got the best product. And, you know, I think Tim highlighted that very well.
I think the industry is evolved holistically. Even if you look at cloud models, the more subscription, you can't really get away with that anymore.
It's key.
You know, the best thing you can do for that second win and that customer is make the first one really successful. Mm-hmm. So Azure role historically used to stop when, you know, they signed the contract and some billable consultants come in, but that's much more blurred line now, because you get to help customer or business unit one as part of your work to get in with business unit two. And you know, I don't mind being on call for that, kind of making sure that what we promised happens. And it can be coordination. It's not you're going to sit there and do the work. You know, just this week, I'm really in love with where Spring is going these days. It's been just going from strength to strength. And one of my favorite projects in there is Spring Cloud Gateway. And a customer's telling me, hey, I need to lock in that this upstream app is going to do a TLS check, and it'll have a client cert, and that will make sure that only that guy routes the calls into Cloud Foundry. And, you know, I got that working yesterday, and it's amazing when you can send them one line of config and say, bind to this service with this config, and you're good to go. And it's like being able to send back, like, it's that easy. You know, another time someone said, we want to limit calls into the APIs, they're sensitive or whatever. And you find out that we've got these filters in that gateway, and you can rate limit, and it's fun. It's just a lot of fun when you can say, look how easy this is.
I want to underline that, the technical piece, because kind of from selfishly, I guess, or from my perspective, I've always liked to work with technical things and find the solution and play with those toys. And being in product development so long, the part I did not like was actually following out all of the, you know, long steps that you have to do, right, to actually get it running. And some of them are tedious, and you got to, you know, all these things. But within the SA role, you get to play with the technology. In fact, you have to, in order to be able to do the rest of your job, you know, install the things in your lab and run Spring Code and develop these apps. But then you can stop. You're like, hey, guys, here is this pearl of wisdom. And they're like, thanks. But then they have the deliverables. And, yep, you know, you've got, they call you again, hey, I got this problem, and you can help them again. But, you know, it's their thing to deliver. And having been in delivery for so long, it's a much different and more relaxed feeling.
Yeah, I think going back to Tim's, you know, trusted advisor, I don't think people realize, I mean, that is a lot of what we do. It's not our job to give customers an answer. It's our job to show them the art of the possible. Right. And I think, you know, all SEs that I work with do a lot of that. They go out and they do their own projects. They work on something that the customer's having a problem with. And it's not to give them an answer. It's to give them an idea, to get the wheels rolling in a certain thing, to say, hey, here's a way to do it. It may not be the right way. It may not even be a great way, but at least it gets you started and you can see where you can go with this. And generally, once you get that, you know, that little spark of an idea in a customer's head, they're able to take whatever the SA's done, they run with it. And hell, even sometimes that stuff that we meaning the SA's and the customers have done together, make their way back into product, right? Hey, that's such a good idea. We need to incorporate this. And that's the other aspect of solutions architectors, not just with the customer, but it's pushed back into product to say, this is what the customers are seeing. There's their pain points. Here are the things that we need to fix. And it plays an important role in driving product. And customers, I don't think, realize how much impact they have on product and what feature sets are going to go in on next iterations.
Yeah. I have another story of an interesting one where we got to architect in real time. We were going to go in. This team had a retail app, 50 million transactions a day at this point. I don't know what it was then. But it was like, hey, teach us Kubernetes. You know, we're looking at modernizing. It's a homegrown app with lots of, you know, bespoke middleware in the layers. But they were getting 3% error rate, and they had more traffic coming that summer. And they had another impact on the weekend. And they said, okay, new plan. Will this work in our Cloud Foundry environment? And this was literally a real-time decision. Could we just go into the platform? And we had this Java app running. It's simple behind the scenes, but we had it running in the platform in 18 hours, like a day or two. And aside from waiting for some DNS domains to be tweaked on the Oracle database downstream, but we were in production in 28 days. And that was one of those really fun speed dating versions of the architecture story, because we ripped out all that homegrown nonsense. And the leaders said afterwards, even the guy who wrote the original stuff was still there. He says, it's physics. I can't compete. I've got two boxes. You've just ripped out all these layers, so your latency is actually better. But my favorite line at the end of it was, their director called it the infinite scale platform. And I thought, oh, I love it. I just love it. And they weren't even in a public cloud. Right. But they had that initially manual, but then later a horizontal auto scaling going on. And they could just add AIs until, you know, Oracle would break. So that was a nice bit of runway. And it just felt really good because they took a risk. We all kind of knew that some people would get in deep water if the thing broke. But it worked, and it worked like a charm. And it really showed the scale of the platform. In fact, I think people originally called it Elastic Runtime.
Mm-hmm.
But it truly is, right? It was spreading your workload across all those boxes, across all those racks. And those Go routers are so scalable. I don't think anything's as fast as those today.
100% agreed. You know, one of the things that kind of, the reason we started Cloud Foundry Weekly is that you don't hear a lot about Cloud Foundry or Tanzu Application Service or even the old PCF. You don't hear a lot about that nowadays. You know, people aren't talking about it, but we know huge customers that are running, you know, 150,000, you know, application instances or more. We've got small startups that are using this. Why do y'all think we're not hearing about Cloud Foundry and the benefits? We all know how great it is. Why do you think we don't hear about it that much? Mark? Feinzy?
Good news doesn't travel like bad news. I think industry is almost fashion-led in infrastructure. And what's the new shiny? And I think that, you know, we all know that Kubernetes gets a lot of the zeitgeist, a lot of the mind share. But I also know there's an awful lot of devs out there just drowning in YAML and just tired of Helm and saying, look, I'm on both sides, and I've been down the Kubernetes path as well. And I've had more customers now coming full circle and doing more with Cloud Foundry this year. And it's been so surreal to kind of put my focus back onto more Cloud Foundry and go, oh my God, this is so easy. And as you know, Nick, you guys are kicking the tires on Corifi as well. Cause I'm like, that's the experience they want in both places when it can be applied. So I think part of it is, another part is that the number one competitor in all my platform service engagements, no matter what the platform, has always been the DIY guy, right? Yep. The guy behind the scenes is going to build, oh, I can do that. And you know what? you can write a bash script and fake a CF push. If you spend a lot of time setting all everything up beforehand, you can fake it. But what I have found the most fun in the Cloud Foundry cycle would be, you do your CF push demo, now hit me. Why wouldn't this work here?
Yeah.
Well, it has no dependencies. The greenfield app, hello world, won't work here. Where's the database? You tell me about service bindings. Yeah, but what if the load balancer? It takes us a week to get an IP address. Don't need it. It's got an ingress controller. Oh, but what if Java needs an update? And so on and so forth. And I really feel that, you know, Kubernetes and Cloud Foundry have really different skill sets as engines. And I almost feel like Kubernetes is the new Bosch. It's south-facing. It's a universal infrastructure for looking down. And I'm seeing more and more and more asks now for that easy button to go on top. But I think an implementation should outlast its API, and the Cloud Foundry experience can be something we strive for everywhere.
Well, and Wayne is on fire today. I think Wayne's trying to go for how many one-liners can I get in a one-hour show? Kubernetes is for startups. Cloud Foundry is for scale-ups. Love that statement. Chris, what about you, man? I agree with Mark. You know, bad news doesn't travel, or good news doesn't travel as fast as bad news.
I tell my the account executives, happy developers are quiet developers, right? They're just doing their thing. I think then there are a set of developers, 10%, you know, they're in ops too, who both want to do their day job and be good at it, and also have a little more misery or curiosity and say, I want to learn something else. I want to try this. How's that thing? And will become visible to the executives and others around there and say, hey, yeah, Cloud Foundry, whatever, but hey, there's this Kubernetes thing that all the cool people are doing, and they kind of get their juices flowing. Some of them, the more capable the company, actually, the more that syndrome can be challenging. Like, so some of the manufacturers, they have extremely talented engineers, you know, both in their core discipline of building their things, as well as in ops and different places, who really should be building maybe software, but they're here at this company, they love this company, and they need something to do. And they think also, and you know, this is almost a good thing, they think everybody else is as smart as they are, right? Everybody else can understand, oh, you just write a YAML to create a binding with a load balancer and just hook it up over here, and then, you know, Bob's your uncle. You know, oh, we don't need anything to you know, load up our nodes because we have Pixie Boot. Oh yeah, something's just gonna flash an operating system on there, and it all really looks good on the napkin, right? Or the whiteboard, and you can feel really smart. You know, I've watched customer engineers say to their executives things like, hey, these two networks are mutually unroutable. They're both 10-dot networks and you can't route across that. I said that in 10 seconds. They will take 5 minutes to say the same thing. And I think they do it intentionally, you know, about delving into network so that those also smart executives who used to be engineers who are promoted up don't want to say, I don't think so, or that sounds too complicated. Why don't we do it the easy way? You know, a lot of these systems are very put together with the cool things all that have all these sharp edges, you know. One thing about Cloud Foundry, it's been around long enough that a lot of the sharp edges are polished off. I'm sure folks who started working with Cloud Foundry in the 1.x days saw the sharp edges. You know, sometimes it's a bag of knives. Well, now that where we're at now, there's not very many sharp edges, right? So it's a little pedestrian maybe, but that's good, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, one of the other things that we're going to kind of switch over to, and I'm going to start with you on this one, Tim. So on Cloud Foundry Weekly, we basically talk about two different products. We talk about Cloud Foundry, which is the open source version. We talk about Tanzu Application Service, otherwise known as PCF or Pivotal Cloud Foundry, which is the commercial version. You know, you've got a mix of both. We've got customers going the OSS route. We've got customers going the commercial route. What are the benefits of the commercial side of Cloud Foundry? If it's OSS, if it's open support or open source, why would you want a commercial version? You know, this is something that we deal with every day. Tim, what's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, it these days it's still a little bit of a niche technology. And it kind of speaks to, you know, why folks don't don't latch on to Cloud Foundry is because abstraction is untrusted, right? So a lot of people, you have to really explain the platform. And because of that, and because it seems like, you know, not always the front and center technology, you lack a little bit of, expertise in the industry. Right. So, mm-hmm. I think that it would really, from a commercial perspective, really help you, do full-time management at a large, scale and really hit that efficiency number that you're looking for in terms of platform operators versus developers, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, making sure that things are the software releases are trusted. There's a lot of questions around how audits can be performed against an OSS ecosystem like Cloud Foundry that is so large. And then you just get sort of people like us, you know, trusted advisors, like I said, people who can help you along the path, help you navigate, help you talk to developers, be able to succinctly communicate those benefits, and just have a partner to go forward and build this journey for you. Because technology, as great as this technology is, it's a people problem, right? It's trying to change the behavior that a development team has been used to for years. And back in 2015, it was, you know, they were working with AWS and OpenStack, and they were totally fine spending, you know, 16 hours a week managing their infrastructure. And then we come in and we have to sort of guide them along the path of, you don't have to work on infrastructure, and that's okay. Like, give us your code and we will run it for you. Yep. And you can just trust that. Taking developers along that journey is hard. It's a mind shift. And I think working with a partner like Tanzu or that has that sort of expertise is good for that journey.
Yep. I'll add and get y'all's opinion on this as well. But you know, the OSS versus the commercial side, you know, there is a distinct difference in you know, putting product out there versus a Bosch add-on versus, you know, with the commercial side of Tile. There are some differences in being able to manage the platform through a UI. It kind of lowers, you know, the commercial side not only lowers that barrier to entry when it comes to technical know-how, but it also lowers the barrier of maintenance, you know, for day-to-day upkeep, making configuration changes, you know. And I think that's one of the things that people need to look at, commercial versus OSS. Yes, there's, you can do everything on the OSS side that you can do on the commercial side and vice versa. It's how much effort do you want to put into it? And you know,
yeah,
unfortunately, Bosch is kind of a dying technical skill. And I think that's something that we want to change. Bosch is still a superpower, to Mark's point.
Yeah.
And it's that mean time to value, right? So, you know, starting off on your journey, going the OSS Cloud Foundry is probably going to be a bit longer. Like I experienced mean time to value was one day on PCI. Yep. And you're not going to achieve that with anything else anywhere. It's not possible.
I think I've got my ops manager, the UI, a guardrail, the wrapper around Bosch that helps us on the commercial side down to like hour and a half if they had their IP ranges for me and they had the credentials for Vista or whatever. But I heard an interesting one from a huge financial institution about why. And this is an organization with all the talent in the world. And it was very simple. Like, why are you directing your talent to certifying a whole bunch of releases with releases of all of the bits that make up this platform when they could be focusing on something above a waterline that would be much more relevant to your organization? He's like, where do you want to put the talent? Because you need a pretty senior person to sign off on everything. And it's a pretty incredible amount of depth in the platform.
Chris, you've been trying to break in there. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, to Tim's point, it's not fully understanding the value of things in an organization from like a CFO, CEO perspective. I think engineers also often think their time is free and that's internalized. Like, I have to have something to do and not really quite get that they could be doing something else. I would say working on your company's core competency that makes you money and not working on things that you could just go purchase. Yeah. I also think about it in terms of risk, and I acquired some of that in business school, and that's often not thought of. Like, what's the risk? Say your, you know, bigcompany.com goes down for some amount of time, right? That's a lot of money. And then how can I have smaller units of risk? And you, I think we see this in like development, where we've moved from these large monthly, semi-monthly, you know, semi-annual releases that, oh, it's risky, I better do it as little as possible. But really what you have is a giant bucket of risk that you're throwing out there, you know, and it's much better to just every few hours really put out tiny little bits of risk, and then you can pull them back if needed. And I think a key argument for a company, a supported product, is you can call, you can, there's someone you can call for help. If it's the dark midnight, you know, in the soul, whatever, you can pick up the phone and people will come rescue you. I remember hearing stories like Cisco has a container full of network gear and a 747 gassed up on the runway. So when somebody makes that call, they're there. And that's what you get. And I think having that, sure, you, with all the other people, but having that is worth a lot of dollars. And I think if a CFO could say, you know, you mean I can avoid this risk by just writing this check?
Yep.
Sign me up, you know? And I think that's, but they're not often the ones who are making that decision or being given enough priming to understand where the decision point is and then make that decision. So I think if that were the case, things would be different.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I think, you know, you bring up one of the things, I'm going to follow in Wayne's one-liner thing. When we talk OSS with customers, one of my favorite statements, you know, when they say, well, yeah, OSS is free. You are correct. OSS is free until it breaks. You know, are you going to be wanting to put the operation of your critical applications on Stack Overflow for support or just out on, you know, Google and Answers? No, you're going to want somebody that works in the product every day, that's a SME in the product. And that's where commercial really shines, is having that support, but also having those tested upgrades. You know, again, with OSS, there's a lot of stuff out there you can do as a Bosch add-on, but how do you know it's going to work until you throw it out there? With the commercial side, you've got a really good, you know, idea that what I'm putting on the platform is going to work, and it works well. Tim, sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I was just saying, like, you know, a good example of what you were saying with risk is kind of that Log4j example from a few years ago, right? So, you know, working with VMware at the time, getting that release the next day, we were patched almost immediately because of their ability to jump in, update the code, work with us to get us a quick patch so that we can run and update our dozens of foundations, and we were ready to rock. So having that assurance in a situation like that is worth millions, potentially billions.
Yep. And go ahead, Mark.
No, it's just that Tim reminds me of a story very similar, but it was a meltdown in Shell Shock and the need for a Linux kernel patch. Mm-hmm. And I never forget, it was one of my favorite responses I think I ever wrote in my career, because I got a note from a security officer saying, it's May. Please detail your plan of attack to have the platforms that are here running Cloud Foundry upgraded by December to mitigate against this issue. And I checked with my operator, and they'd already rolled the cadence releases of the stem cells in. I was able to save 0 hours needed, job done. And 1,000 applications, done. And I'm just like, you know, going back to earlier, we're talking about measuring and monitoring and stuff, and how the good news never gets put on a megaphone. You know, the bad news when something breaks does.
Yep. But,
you know, that message that how many dollars were saved right there relative to almost any other option in that organization at the time, which, you know, segues me over into thinking that one of the most important metrics, as you know, Nikki, is how often do people change a line of code, and what does a dollar cost in Cloud Foundry for changing a line of code? Because when you roll a platform update, you're changing an awful lot of lines of code technically across thousands of applications.
Yep. Basically. And it's interesting, man, y'all are bringing up all kinds of points I want to hit. We'll hit the first one. You know, it is interesting that Cloud Foundry is actually, you know, people that put out Cloud Foundry are actually able to move faster than the policies of their corporation that they work for, right? Change management, things of that nature. You're changing lines of code with Cloud Foundry we're talking minutes to get a change out versus days, weeks, sometimes months when it comes, you know, you're looking at change management processes. You know, the Log4j stuff. We all remember Log4j. It wasn't just one patch. I think at the end there were like four patches that came out for Log4j. Yeah. And it was one of the places where a very good big financial company for us came back and said, man, am I glad that we're on this platform, because they were able to hit each one of those patches within 12 hours of it, you know, coming out, whereas the rest of the company never got past the first patch. It took them months to get all those patches through where they were able to protect everything. And I think that comes back to full circle, back to Chris's, you know, statements about risk is, you know, the tagline for Cloud Foundry Weekly is, you know, unleashing past potential one episode at a time. People forget about the potential of PaaS and everything that it does for you. And, you know, we look at things like federal customers and government customers that come in and they pick Cloud Foundry specifically because once you certify the platform is secure, by default, the applications go on it. The authority to operate when you're using a platform is cut in half or even more versus, you know, build your own, roll your own, or even using native sources, even, you know, GovCloud, things of that nature. So, you know, on that topic, anything that y'all want to add, authority to operate, bringing the PaaS up, people forget the potential of PaaS. What are your thoughts on that? Tim?
Yeah,
oh, I caught you. I caught you doing something else.
No,
you
were multitasking. No.
Got his hand in the cookie jar doing something else.
Yeah, you know. no, I think, you know, the authority to run is it's hard because it's something that like I was saying sort of towards the other question of, you know, why is it not taking hold like something like Kubernetes? And it's because with the abstraction of this platform, it's hard to sort of explain to people, and it's hard to sort of get that trust for the platform that that is just sort of inherently there with things that with technologies that people just inherently understand. So being able to sort of explain and show the benefit in a concise and understandable way is half the job, honestly. It's really trying to explain up and explain down, explain up to executives the sort of the business benefits and how that works out, and then having to explain the inner workings of why this is so easy and why you should trust this and why is it secure. That's really what it takes. And ironically, with such an easy platform like this, it's very difficult to get trust out from it or for it.
Man, we are, I cannot believe how fast 60 minutes went with you guys. I got a couple more things that I want to hit on real quick. We'll take the time you need, but you know, we are starting to wrap up. Tim, one of the things that solution architects do is, you know, not only provide the idea, but we also train. I know that you're working on some training products, you know, both like TAS 101 for the developer side, PE 101 for the operations side. Give us kind of a quick idea or a quick synopsis of what your training looks like.
Yeah, so I think you have to take it from two perspectives. You have to train the developers on what it means to run their software development lifecycle on something like CF. So trying to help them understand how interfacing deploying on Cloud Foundry works, and then, you know, operating on Cloud Foundry. So health checking, making sure that you're properly integrated with global load balancing, making sure that your pipelines are well integrated and automated in a correct fashion. So that's sort of a training we've been working on. We delivered it for a client of ours. It worked out pretty well. So that's something that, you know, we have a lot of obviously experience and internal knowledge. It's something I've been doing for the last 10 years is working with developers trying to understand the platform. And then from the platform engineering perspective, sort of from the Bosch and ops manager perspective, how to properly manage this solution, how to understand what Bosch does under the covers, how do you troubleshoot, and then what does ops manager bring to you? And then, you know, on top of that, sort of a practice-based training, which we call back here internally at Tanzu is platform health markers. So understanding the best practices from a practice perspective of your team. Are you treating it, your platform as a product? Are you properly automated? Do you have capacity planning in place? All of these things kind of fold together into how to run this platform successfully and scale it to hundreds of thousands of AIs.
Gotcha. Mark, we'll go to you. I wanted to bring up, I know you're doing some interesting things with Karifi. Have you got anything out there on GitHub, you know, as a project, anything that you're working on? Kind of tell us about what you're doing with Karifi, because I thought that was, that was really interesting.
So very quickly. So, you know, I like I said, I fell in love with the API, with Cloud Foundry push years ago. Went off and did a lot on the Kubernetes side. Then I had a look at Karifi and went, wow, these guys have got this really great convergence angle here where you can have a Cloud Foundry on your laptop because you can have that CF push and it's implemented using native Kubernetes types under the cover. So you just one layer below the surface and you can kind of have a foot in both sides. So what I've been looking at are things like, you know, being able to create services because no app is an island. Everything needs to find its dependencies downstream. So I've been looking at how do you put services into your virtual, into your Cloud Foundry space, even though you might be running on a tiny Kubernetes cluster. And you know that experience of keeping the developer with that landing zone for their apps. The other thing I'd quickly say is that, you know, when it comes to the platform, I'll put a link in there. One of my favorite Spring Boot talks is about going to production in 10 minutes. And the most important part of that was something we were touching on a few minutes ago, which was, you know, when you get this figured out or deployed, now you can focus on the outside. You can look outward. You can talk to your change management people. You can show them how it's safe to move fast. You can invest in having enough testing automated so that you can say, look, the risk here of this button going and rolling up a change in production with an undo button if the smoke test fails is getting us to the point where you can get basically continuous compliance approvals. So, yeah, I'm toggling, Nikki, sorry, I'm 1 minute I'm in the weeds of Karifi and CF instance service instance types. The next minute I'm talking about, you know, dealing with your change management people.
Well, it's all related, you know. I'm the first person that when it comes to the Kubernetes conversation, you know, customers start talking, we need to go Kubernetes. I'm going to be the very first person that asks them why. Why do you need to go Kubernetes? What's the driving force? I think there is a huge place for Kubernetes, but I think people forget about the easy button. You've heard the Apple versus Android analogy here, but it's really great to see someone kind of bridging those two stories together like what you're doing, Mark. If you get me a link, if you've got a GitHub repo out there that's public, get me the link. We'll make sure we include it in the show notes. And Chris, we'll start out with you. Anything interesting that you want to talk about? Anything you got going on that you should let people know about?
Yeah. So I was kind of looking at where do all these platforms intersect, right? So there's Kubernetes and it provides, you know, container virtual compute on demand. But then a lot of people use Lambda or Google GKE or not GKE, but Google Cloud Platform or things on top of Kubernetes like Knative. And what do all these have in common? And it turns out it's build packs. So I was looking in a lot of depth at the build packs and kind of devising some systems that were a bit hacking on Cloud Foundry and other things to say, hey, can a developer or someone in the pipeline change a line or two of configuration and then have the same Spring project go to Cloud Foundry, go to Cloud Run, go to Lambda? Because the developers, if they don't care about the platform, they shouldn't care about the platform, right, as far as even where that might go. And one of the reasons I did it is to engage in this conversation with a customer who thought, hey, these things are kind of equal. Well, if we factor out the developer experience a little bit, let's look at the platform itself, right? And then we could look at, hey, does this come with canaries? Does this have, you know, how do we scale those different things? And then have that be a bit of more of a conversation.
Yep. Well, like I said, guys, I mean, you know, if there's anything you want me to put in, if you're working on anything, Chris, you want to put in there, if you got something going on, let me know. We'll put it in the show notes. To the audience, man, we love our audience. We got the best audience in the world. Thank you all for showing up. Special thanks to Wayne. I know he had to jump for a meeting, he said on the chat, but loved all the one-liners, man. You should write a book on those things. Appreciate y'all showing up. To the panel, man, this was a great episode. Like I said, I think I could probably go on for another hour with you guys. We didn't even hit half the topics that we wanted to talk about, so maybe we'll do another part two of this one because it was absolutely awesome. For the audience, make sure that you go down, hit the notification bell. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you see when things are coming out. Don't forget, May 15th, we're going to be at Cloud Foundry Day. Hope to see people there. We'll have stickers. We'll be doing some live shows. We're going to put together a big video that we're going to post on there about everybody's CF Push experience. So come look for me and Nick. Tim says he's going to be there. And on Tim's, again, towards Tim, he's got that training out there. If your company wants to see some training, you need TAS 101. You want to update your platform engineers to some of the stuff that's coming out. Look for Tim on LinkedIn. Reach out to him. Reach out to me, Chris, Mark Fiennes. We'll have all the LinkedIn profiles in the description at the end. And everybody have a great day. As we always sign off, CF bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Cloud Foundry Weekly. Feel free to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or check us out at cloudfounderyweekly.com. Thank you.